Welcome to the Philip Wiley Show. Take a look behind the curtain of professional hacking and hear compelling discussions with guests from diverse backgrounds who share a common curiosity and passion for challenges and their job. And now, here's your host, offensive security professional, educator, mentor, and author, Philip Wiley.
Hello and welcome to another episode. Today I've got Justin Elzey from Trusted Sec joining today. So Justin's got a lot of experience in cybersecurity and the defensive security side of things. He's the CTO of Trusted Sec, one of my favorite pen testing companies out there. You know, there's a few companies out there, a handful of companies that I really follow the tools and the things that they put out there and follow the folks on their team. So Trusted Sec is one of those pen testing firms that I really follow. So welcome to the show, Justin.
Hey, thanks for having me. Kind of covered it. CTO at Trusted Sec. I'm also over the research team and the red team here. So I dabble in a little bit of everything. And kind of in this space for 14 years now, I think, full time, something like that.
Well, that's good. So if you wouldn't mind kind of sharing your origin story of kind of how you got started.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I came up with a lot of people did, I guess dating myself now, I guess, but IRC, that sort of thing, back in the day, I'd always wanted to do cybersecurity and hacking for a living. I did computer repair. So this kind of helps frame a lot of things. So I did computer repair for a while. Did system engineering, network engineering. And during the system and network days, I was, got my OSCP, got my CEH, and I was always trying to transition into, OFSEC. I think the biggest problem then was nobody wanted to hire you with no experience. Once you had one day of experience, anybody would hire you. So I got my lucky break at a company called Redspin. They hired me, it was work from home, and that was 14 years ago. So at the time, telling my friends and stuff, I'm like, oh, I got a new job. I don't go into work. And people were like, sure you have a job, that sort of thing. So I got my first gig with them. They gave me a break and, kind of just jumped around from there. Was at Redspin for, let's say, a year and a half, 2 years. Went to Accuvant for a while. SecureWorks for a short period of time. Actually went back to Optiv, which Accuvant Labs, Optiv at the time. Was at FusionX. They mostly do red teaming. They're a smaller boutique. They're on my Accenture now. And then I spent a bunch of time at Trusted Sec and I kind of worked my way up the ranks there.
Very cool. Yeah, Redspin is one I hadn't heard in a long time, but I remember Redspin.
Yeah, actually, you talked to Jason Haddix earlier today. Yes. He was at Redspin the generation before me. So him and a bunch of people started there. When that group left, I actually came in after them and they all have done great things since. And it's a really small world.
Yeah, that's very cool. So, what do you do in your role at Trusted Sec as, as the CTO?
Yeah, so I do everything. It's a little bit of everything. So, I do all of the pre-sales and the sales work for red teaming. Just because I think a lot of people appreciate the scoping side of that. There's not a salesperson just trying to sell, whatever. We jump right into kind of technical scoping. I do that. And then basically over the red team and research team. So Jason Lang runs the red team. So I work with him. I'll jump into engagements from time to time, help out. And then the research team, I'll kind of put my hands into that as well as sometimes. Both those teams are self-sufficient now. I just kind of help steer direction, things like that. I do get involved with IT stuff from here day to day, which is if you work in security and you work in a place where everybody used to do system admin, network admin, and now they're a hacker, doing IT or anything IT related is not where you want to be because everybody is either an expert or still thinks they're an expert. So it's one of those places where, everybody wants to give advice on how to fix things and they all have very good advice, but it just makes working in IT here interesting. So that's mainly what I do. I get pulled into special projects. I'll still pen test. I'll still red team. Mostly because I just don't want to lose those skills. The other thing I like to do is like emerging event stuff. So every once in a while, there'd be like a CVE that drops or some event. So I might need to pull together a proof of concept, write some detection rules, RE something. So I'll kind of usually spearhead that sort of activity. Just like to stay hands-on with all that stuff, basically.
Yeah, that's good. Definitely something you don't want to lose after putting all the effort in all those years to get good at it and then turn around and stop it. Yeah, it's kind of tough.
Yeah, if I couldn't do the technical stuff, I probably wouldn't keep this job. Like I know a lot of people move to like leadership when they're kind of like, all right, I don't want to keep up with this pace, but like I still enjoy, you know, following all the TTPs and things that are happening in the wild. You know, I still enjoy reversing malware, you know, building POCs, stuff like that. So I'm not ready to just move on to like leadership yet, which is, you know, we're still small enough that, you know, I can do all those things. I don't think other places would be that flexible, but it's a good balance for me.
Yeah, it seems like you get more into the corporate environments, you probably wouldn't be able to do as much of that.
Yeah.
So was that hard for you to make the move into management? Although you mentioned you're not 100%, you still get to be technical, but was that a hard move or hard decision for you to make?
So I don't think it wasn't like a sudden thing. So it's been a slow transition. So I started at TrustedSec. I think we had 15 or 16 employees. We're like 130 something now. So during that time period, I was a principal consultant. And then at one point, you know, I kind of pitched Dave on, we need to do a research team. Like we need, like things are getting harder year over year. We need a dedicated research team. So I got kind of that off the ground, spun up the red team. So then those things were just kind of a natural transition. I think I took over IT mostly because we didn't have somebody who could do it full time. So that was a, you know, I don't love it, but it's something that needs to happen. And that's kind of the way things have played out. Like there's a whole, you know, we have something we need to fill. And I've kind of just went into those roles. So I don't think any of it was intentional. Like I'd still be happy being a principal consultant. I think it's just, I like to take the experiences I have into like sales and the rest of the stuff and just the kind of the way you run business, it worked out. So definitely I never, you know, started my career path going, I want to be a CTO someday. It's almost happened a couple times in some other roles. Like when I was system engineering and stuff like that and some VoIP companies and stuff, I kind of went down that path, but not planned, you know, worked out. I'm happy where I am. You know, balancing all those things together works out.
So what would you recommend to someone that wanted to get into offensive security?
Yeah, so there was a lot of talk on Twitter this weekend about that. So I interview a lot of people, and I work with Martin Boss, who, you know, hires a lot of people for the Force team, which is our pen testing team. There's a couple scenarios that happen. People work their way up through like system admin jobs, start doing CTFs and things like that, and then want to get into OFSEC. If that's the case, I usually still promote like OSCP. There's like red team ops classes and a bunch of those are all very good. It doesn't really matter which. I think people still look for OSCP pretty, you know, as a standard thing. But the biggest thing for me is making sure that you can kind of convey those in a resume. So we get a lot of people that will apply and they'll say, hey, I want to be a pen tester. And they'll send us their sysadmin resume and not say any of that stuff. They might be taking the OSCP. They might do CTFs. They might read blogs. They might do all those things. Like, I almost want people to bring back cover letters for when you get your first job, just because you're looking up, you know, we post a job and we get, you know, hundreds and hundreds of resumes. It's really hard to call every single person and say, you know, give me your life story. Let's take an hour and a half. So I think for me, the big thing is if you want to get in this space and you don't have experience, just highlight some of those things that make you, you know, why are you coming to this space? What are you trying to do to get there? That's the biggest thing for me. I always look for that stuff, even simple things like, hey, I went to the local B-sides and volunteered, stuff like that. Those always stand out. You know, once you have experience, you know, once you've had a job somewhere, normally we interview people and just have a conversation. You know, what's your favorite hack you've done? Obviously, you know, don't give away any, you know, client information, but you know, like your favorite hack, like what cool exploits from the last year. Usually you can have a conversation and figure out, you know, pretty quickly, you know, where people are once they've had a little bit of experience. Just the hardest piece is just the first job, getting your foot in the door. And I think that's just finding ways to highlight, you know, that you are interested in this space and, you know, what, you know, steps you've kind of taken to go in that direction.
So what are some interview tips you give? You mentioned, you know, the cover letter and kind of doing documenting things to show what you've done to learn pen testing. So what are some good interview tips?
Yeah, I'll start with one that is kind of funny. Don't try to hack the people you're talking to. So we've had that a couple times. People will throw resumes over the fence with like a macro or try to like use a backdoor, like a PDF file or something like that. It's funny. Like, I appreciate it. However, I know that like lots of organizations that aren't us would not find it as funny. the interview tips is really like, just be honest. I think, you know, it's really, and this is like a cliche because everybody always says this, but if you don't know something, just explain you don't know it. Explain the process you would do to problem solve, right? If I said, you know, how do I use some CVE and you weren't familiar, okay, cool. You go to ExploitDB, you go read a blog, you know, you test in a lab, that sort of thing. I look for more, you know, that side of thing, just conversational stuff. We usually ask people, you know, like what they don't like about this job, and it's usually reporting and things like that. And then that leads to, you know, what have you done to kind of, you know, mitigate that piece of the job? So I'm always really big on just, you know, back and forth. The other thing I've seen is just, you know, people fear job hopping. I think if you can, you know, kind of articulate, hey, I left here after a year for money. I left here after 7 months for career progression, that sort of thing, opportunity. Like, I never hold that against anybody. It just helps if you have a, you know, what you're going to say kind of thought out all the time. That's a big one for me. And I've done a lot of career jumping in my history, so I never judge anybody by that. However, I know I've seen people get feedback from other companies, other managers, where they got a hard time about it. But I think if you can just say, hey, you know, I was junior here, I moved up, I was ready to go to a bigger firm, become, you know, senior, even if that was, you know, 12, 18 months, that sort of thing. But I think just knowing the hard questions that people will ask you in an interview, just kind of be preparing for those. The technical stuff, I'm not a big fan of grilling people. Like, hey, what does this acronym mean? Like, you would Google, or like the OSI model, stuff like that. Like, things that you could look up. It's more about problem solving. And then the other part of OFSEC, at least in the consulting, is dealing with clients, like writing reports, dealing with angry clients, you know, conveying a message to them. Like, because a lot of times you're, you know, your red team or AppSec test or whatever it is, you're coming back with something that's probably not always what they want to hear, right? Like, everybody's great, like you found a bug, but at the same time, hey, your Active Directory environment, everything is broken and you have a giant list to fix. Depending on how you frame that, like, hey, we owned you and you guys suck, isn't the response, you know, you don't get the same level of response from kind of, you know, articulating, say, hey, we found these things, but here's a path to remediate and you'll be better because of it. So some of that just comes with experience, but, you know, having some ability to have empathy for your clients. Another piece of that is, I think a lot of people come into the space and will say, you know, just go fix all the problems, right? Like, what does that mean? Well, if you are from an enterprise and you realize what a change management process looks like, you know, like being able to roll something back, all of those steps, it's not as easy as just go fix things. Like, there's production, there's lots of money on the line. So I think it, you know, junior pen testers and people who don't have a ton of experience kind of look at things like, hey, this is critical, go immediately fix this. Well, businesses need to make money. So making sure you understand that, you know, you just be able to step them through the process. A good example was like NetBIOS name spoofing is big on every pen test. You know, people would say, just go turn it off everywhere. Well, maybe a better strategy is to turn it off on the workstations first, see what impact there is, then turn it off on servers. Because for servers, occasionally you would find like a SQL database where somebody didn't put a DNS entry in. And if you break everything at once, it's a lot harder to figure out, you know, where things were. But splitting those two groups, it's just an easy way to break the task down into two parts that helps you fix problems when they crop up because you made the change. Just stuff like that. It's experience and kind of, you know, understanding the business needs to run.
Yeah, those are some great points. Another thing too, I think that's helpful for people wanting to get into, and I think it's nice for folks that have an IT sysadmin network administrator background when you're doing roles like pen testing, is when you're in there doing your testing, you're careful not to break stuff because, you know, we understand what it's like if they have to restore some, rebuild a system because of your pen test, and you know, keeping in mind that type of thing, that business needs to continue and not making more work for the customer.
Yeah, there's a lot of differing opinions on if people should have experience in IT or whatever, or just go straight into OFSEC. And I don't necessarily think people need system admin, network engineer experience. However, I think you should, if your plan is to do pen testing, consulting, to at least have done something else in tech first, you know, development, help desk, SOC, something like that, because I think you need those life lessons. And everybody who, you know, comes up in pen testing that I've seen pulls from those things all the time. Like my friends that are network engineers tend to go after VoIP systems and Cisco stuff on pen test. You know, my friends that were Active Directory have been doing much better there. You pull from those life lessons. I think it's really hard to say, hey, just go pen test without any context for, you know, how business works. You know, have you opened some trouble tickets in your life? You know, just basic, you know, enterprise tasks and things like that. I think you need that background to kind of really appreciate this stuff.
So yeah, I was at a conference recently, I guess a couple years ago now. I guess it was like a year ago in the fall, and the presenter was presenting on building red teams. And one of the comments they made is they think it's, I don't know if they said impossible, I think it's really difficult to turn pen testers into red teamers. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think, so we've done it and it works. The things you run into are, pen testers by nature are used to shorter engagements. And it's a big task to get people to learn to slow down. And then once they learn to slow down, they eventually end up in a different spot where they get like command paralysis of, being afraid to run something or do something because they don't want to get caught. You know, you land a fish, you're in a system for a week and a half. If you get caught, a lot of times they might roll all that back. So you're extremely cautious and you have to kind of build a balancing act between, you know, getting things done and not getting caught. And that's a tough thing for them. The other piece I've seen is, you know, pen testing. If you've been doing this, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, you're very used to getting domain admin. You're very used to, you know, knocking everything over and winning. Red teaming is not like that anymore. EDR, really good blue teams, really good MSSPs. You're going to get caught and you're not going to get all your goals. And I think that, you know, people spend all that time being used to winning on the pen test side is a very hard thing for them to kind of deal with. And I know it's weird to talk about like the emotional aspects and the stress aspects of doing this stuff, but people really beat themselves up over, you know, getting caught and not getting to all the goals that a client might have. And that's a really different transition for, you know, pen testers to kind of come up. It's completely possible. And I think the thing that makes it work or makes the transition easier is actually using the team. A lot of red team shops will, put 1-2 people on an engagement, and that's fine. And we do the same thing, but just making sure that you're meeting with the rest of the team on a regular basis, that lines of communication are open for chat, use the team and say, hey, I'm here, I'm stuck. What would you guys do? That sort of thing. That's something we've leaned on heavily, as well as, pulling people into situations. So you're on an internal engagement, maybe you find a website with a server-side request forgery. You might pull somebody from our web app team to say, hey, can you help me weaponize this quicker? Or, you know, you're in AWS and you're not sure how to do something specific, you know, pull somebody from our cloud team in. So it's just the space, it used to be easy to be very good or above average at like everything in OFSEC. You can't do that anymore. So you really need to be able to pull from your, you know, friends, your network, that sort of thing for direction, advice, stuff like that.
So kind of to follow on to that subject a little bit further. So what do you think about specialization? At what point in someone's career should they specialize in a certain area of offensive security?
So I'm always torn on this. I think that, you know, everybody wants to do like AI security now, right? And I think AI is great. And I think like there's a space for it. Things are moving very quickly there. So that's a tough one. However, if you look at cloud, for example, everybody, like everything is hybrid now. So you need some balance there. I think that you kind of need to look at where you are today, where you think things will be in 5 years. I've seen people put themselves into like really niche specialties and, I wouldn't say regret it, but you kind of, you know, really pigeonhole yourself. So like, I just do container security. Well, that's great, but does the company you work for, you know, is that level of work going to be there forever? So it's just, I think you need to strike that balance between, you know, where things are going and what you want to do, and if there's actually a market for it. I don't know. There's so Red Team's a good example. You know, 6-7 years ago, people weren't running malware, you know, like doing syscalls and the things they're doing now. Now it's almost a requirement to do those things. So I've also debated with other people about this is like, should we split the Red Team up into these are the two people who are really good at phishing. These are the two people that are good at post exploitation. And, you know, in a consulting shop, the amount of like work that you need to perfectly schedule to make that work is almost impossible. So I'm still not a big advocate for over specializing. I think just kind of seeing where things are trending. Like if, you know, today, if you're like getting into red teaming or, you know, you got your first red teaming job, you know, take those malware dev classes because that's the direction things are going, right? Take some cloud classes. That's the thing, or, you know, things are going like the on-prem AD stuff, really, really well documented. And, you know, new techniques come out like ADCS stuff from Spectre Ops, but that's not moving at the same clip. A lot of this is driven by like EDR. So now, you know, in the past used to be this fighting technical misconfigurations, getting around AV, you know, EDR updates come daily, weekly, monthly. So if you write some new malware technique or whatever is hot this week, you know, may not work in a few months. So just, you know, kind of balancing where things are going, like I said.
So you kind of mentioned some certifications early on. So what certifications do you recommend for people these days?
So the Red Team Ops class is good. Rasta Mouse's class. Eventually you get to a point in this space where all of the classes in OFSEC cover 85-90% of the same thing. You may learn 5-10% net new. At that point, I would look into specializing, taking specialized classes. So Sector 7 has persistence classes, has malware classes. Malware Dev Academy has modules on writing malware. I think that once you get to a certain point of doing this, you really just need to focus on, hey, I found a really good class on AWS, found a really good class on enumeration. Those broad catch-all classes are fine. You just don't end up getting as much. Like you just need to deep dive focus to get better at this.
Yeah, it's the Rasta Mouse's class. That's that zero point security was a pretty good class. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, I thought that was interesting now also too, that the way the class has been updated, because before when you took it, if you were going to use Cobalt Strike, you'd have to have your own license. And so at least it's nice now that they actually include that in the labs, and the labs are kind of segmented, because used to you're kind of like the OSCP where everyone was in the same lab. And now it's kind of segmented, which is kind of nice because you get that false sense of security because someone has done something, makes it easier to exploit, and you don't know what's been done in the background. Then you go back if the lab's refreshed and you try to get in, you can't get in again. So that's kind of nice that they've went to that, the segmented labs like that.
Yeah, I'm kind of waiting to see when Cobalt Strike, you know, falls off for different shops and different classes. Like Cobalt Strike's really effective, and it's still, you know, Metasploit was the gold standard, then Cobalt Strike was the gold standard. But now you start to see the level of effort it takes to get Cobalt Strike past SentinelOne, CrowdStrike, things like that is, you know, at almost a tipping point where how much do I want to invest to just be able to get an implant running with Cobalt Strike? You know, if my own R&D costs exceed, you know, X, maybe I should switch to something else. So it's been interesting watching that. Like, we still love Cobalt Strike. We still use it. We have some internal implants and things like that that are, you know, feature parity with it. But you're starting to see, you know, Nighthawk and Brutal Hotel and some of these other tools pop up because, you know, CrowdStrike, Cobalt Strike was just, you know, so popular. Like, as soon as ransomware actors all took it over, you really could see the direction things were going. Like, you know, there's only so many public implants that are used. There's only so many techniques, and it's like, well, it's Cobalt Strike, it's in packets, WMI-exec. There's all, you know, these things. Let's just throw all our attention at that, and that's what those vendors did. So, you know, to curve the ransomware problem in a fast fashion, it made sense. Now it's kind of like, does that make enough sense to still use in the wild? So, on the adversary emulation side, yeah, we need to keep Cobalt Strike around for this. On like the red teaming side, where the client's kind of weighing, we want you to get in and at least do X, Y, and Z, you know, Cobalt Strike is working against you in that situation. So it's an interesting time for those products.
Yeah. So what do you think of like assumed breach type of assessments?
Yeah. So I think that we're going to end up in a space where there's way more assumed breaches. So, you know, red teams, you know, so when I say red team, I say, you know, outside in approach, you know, looking at web apps, social engineering, OSINT, all those pieces, trying to get in and get to goals. You know, those run anywhere from 5 weeks to like 3-4 months. The clients that can afford a, you know, a longer red team are highly investing in security, but they're not going to forever add time to these engagements. They're not going to go, hey, you know, we do 2-month red teams, you know, we put a lot of money in, we're going to do 5-month red teams. Like, it just doesn't make sense. So you're already starting to see this. They'll pick specific goals and put you in a specific spot and maybe do more like micro engagements. And when I say micro, I'm still talking like 3-4 weeks, but just, hey, we're going to treat you as a developer gone rogue, or we're going to put you on an appliance and simulate like a CVE and, you know, put you on like a Netscale or a VPN box and go from there. So I think assumed breach is really going to be the future. It's because you can't forever add to engagements. When we do red teams, if we don't get reliable access by a certain point, we have a conversation about going to assumed breach always. We have clients that only care about getting in externally, and that's fine. But most clients are, you know, hey, let's go to assumed breach. This makes sense at this point. You know, during COVID, we had a funny thing happen. We would land on machines and people would work like half the day. So we'd be in this position of having to tell a client like, hey, we're on this laptop, but you know, they work 3 hours a day, like we can't operate from here. And that kind of drove a lot of the assumed breach stuff for us. I think, you know, people shied away from it for a while. I think that we're like saying, hey, you know, we should be able to get in. But, you know, some of these clients, you know, used to be able to send multiple phishing emails a day. Now it's to spin up a campaign, to test on an endpoint, to do all those things takes, you know, half a day, 2 days, 3 days. It just, you know, how many of those can you get out and make it worth it for the client to get a good return? I think things will work themselves out in the next couple of years. I think assumed breach will get more defined. I think people will pick scenarios that make sense for them depending on events. I do really think that, you know, appliance-based assumed breach is going to take off. You know, everybody focuses on endpoints, makes sense, you know, phishing, all those things. But, you know, if you look at how companies have been breached the last several years, there's, you know, cloud credentials or, you know, simulating some like MFA bypass, stuff like that. I think you can kind of spread those out a little bit.
Yeah, to me, it just makes a lot of good sense, because when you figure times that, you know, disgruntled employees may sell credentials, and if you're trying to get in just totally outside in, like you mentioned, or black box approach, doesn't mean you're secure. What happens if you've got someone gets a hold of credentials are sold, or you have someone, you know, I've heard of companies hiring like nation state operators that went in, applied like a legitimate employee, have legitimate access to network, and they can exfil and steal intellectual property. So it seems like it kind of makes sense for people to keep that in mind, because just because you can't break in doesn't mean you're secure. So what do you think about like purple team operations and that type of stuff?
Yeah. So I love purple teaming as well. I think it's, you know, people got red team reports and didn't always necessarily know how to digest them. So at least the way we approach purple teaming is, we call purple teaming anytime we go and add net new detections or tune detections for a client. So like the red team might do an engagement, and at the end of the engagement, you might say, hey, replay a couple of the attacks you did. Like we still bucket that with offense and red team. When we engage we have a separate purple team. When we engage the purple team, their engagements are always an expert on whatever SIM you have. And then we kind of jump in and then write detections. It might be off of the previous pen test report or red team report, or kind of out of a playbook we have. And one of the things we've also been a big advocate for is, I've seen other companies do this. You replay an attack, they go in the SIM and they go, oh, we don't have XYZ, you know, event ID in here. You know, we always say, well, what else do you have? You know, hey, we have CrowdStrike. Well, CrowdStrike has similar telemetry. we'll write the detection in CrowdStrike as well. So we do some stuff like that. And I think that, you know, the companies have a hard time getting talent that understands offense and defense. You'll get some amazing people who can write KQL and write really elaborate detections. They don't necessarily understand the things that happen before and after an attack happens. And that's a piece we've been bridging a lot of times for companies. We've actually been getting more these days into, we need somebody to just come in here, replay attacks and explain them to us, versus the, you know, the hands-on writing detections. So I think that, you know, blue teams have really been making strides in the last several years becoming, you know, hey, we're going to be a Splunk shop. Let's get really good at this. You know, where we struggle is the nuts and bolts of, you know, particular attacks, and especially like why a red team did something or why this attack looks like this. You know, the full context there has been a big help for all the people we work with.
Yeah, it just seems like a good thing to do. Just and it's nice that you're mentioning how some of your red team or offensive security engagements that you go back and help write the detections. So it's good to see things evolving that way, because, you know, sometimes you go back, companies get pen test after pen test, and they're not really seeing much progress. Either they don't have the bandwidth to remediate or the budget to remediate things. And to be able to, it seems like the purple teaming thing is a way to help mature your defenses a little bit quicker than going through the typical offensive security assessments, remediate, and keep repeating that cycle.
You know, we ran into a fun spot with this. So at one point, our red team and our pen test team did a lot of the work with our official purple team. And then we realized, like, hey, we have clients that come to us year over year for red team. Like, I can't have my red team necessarily writing detections and then attacking the same company, because there's like, you just have bias, you know, how things are written and things like that. So that's why we kind of split the two. You know, we share and work back and forth, but the quarterly reoccurring clients, that was kind of an interesting thing for us to kind of attack and solve, because it was, hey, we're going to write a detection for phishing and things we did last time. Well, I know that there's a gap here for this process or that sort of thing. So we've kind of adjusted for that. We've made it work, but that was a interesting road bump along the way of, you know, building this out over the last 6-7 years.
And so for people listening that may be looking for pen testing services, how would you recommend someone find a good offensive security consulting company? What are some ways they can look? Of course, Trusted Sec's awesome, but how would you go out and be able to vet these different companies to find a good one?
Yeah, so first of all, don't call in Q4 because everybody's trying to get work done for compliance that time of year. I would definitely like to see a sample report from the client, you know, see what you're getting, understand what you're getting, that sort of thing. Another thing I've seen work really well is, you know, finding out the testers who's going to work on your engagement ahead of time. So, you know, people complain about like bait and switch with bigger consulting firms. Hey, the senior does the kickoff call and some junior person does the work. So most of the bigger companies will offer bios or let you talk to a client or talk to a consultant before an engagement. So, you know, seeing the report and having some sort of rapport with the consultant ahead of time, I think are the biggest two ones. You know, walking through methodology and things like that are great, but the report is really what you're going to digest. The other piece I'd probably ask about is, what does the outbrief procedure look like? So, you know, are they going to do a full technical debrief? Are they going to do an executive one? You know, what's their appetite for additional calls? So one of the things, you know, we've done, and I know some other companies do, is we kind of include, you know, 3 or 4 phone calls, or really it's as many as you want, but, you know, we'll do a full exec or a full technical outbrief. Maybe they have a bunch of cloud issues. The cloud team might not speak up on a big technical call because they don't want to like look bad or whatever. So us offering, you know, out brief phone calls for just a particular team has really gone a long way. And I know other people do it as well. So, you know, you get the cloud team on the phone with just the tester, 3-4 people, maybe, they'll say, hey, we know we have a big gap over here. We, you know, we didn't want to say anything on the other call. Can you kind of explain, you know, what you guys did and why? So I think that goes a long way too, is just making sure that the, you know, somebody's not going to give you a report and then go run off, you know, into the mist, making sure that they're there to kind of support you after you have the report to digest it at, you know, different levels that you need.
So we're getting down towards the end of the show. Is there anything you'd like to share before we conclude?
I was just thinking back to the red team assumed breach piece. I will say that, I forgot to mention this before. So assumed breach is great. I would not remove external and OSINT from your testing strategy. The assumed breach is a good mitigator for spending a bunch of time on social engineering. Because we still find clients where we can credential spray, like very, very mature, very good organizations might have some NTLM portal they forgot about, or their MDM, is only single factor. We find web apps that are not tied to their IAM provider. So previous breach credentials or cred spraying still works to get into those. Those login portals might have been tested for pen testing and things like that, where, hey, somebody pointed, burp at it, the login page, couldn't find anything and moved on. But like a simple user account, there's ways to break into the app. So I would never discount the external OSINT web app side out of that picture, because I've seen people say, hey, there's no way you're going to get an external when we found things. I think I would just use the assumed breach to kind of mitigate the social engineering aspect of these engagements. That's a big takeaway. I get it. Like it blows my mind when we break into companies with like web app stuff or credential spraying when they're huge and have like everything locked down. And like, if you were on a workstation, it would be extremely hard to do anything, but like they're so big that, things happen, mistakes are made. Like that's why you're doing this. So that's just a big thing I advocate for. If people are looking to just do assume breach, just make sure you are still thinking about external, like that didn't go away. Like you haven't fixed that problem.
Yeah. Great advice. So I appreciate you taking time to join me today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. I always like talking about this stuff.
Yeah. That's great. Thanks everyone. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Thank you for listening to The Philip Wiley Show. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. In the meantime, to learn more about Philip, go to thehackermaker.com and connect with him on LinkedIn and Twitter at Philip Wiley. Until next time.